So the topic that we're going to pick up on is the question of the role of the poseg when deciding facts. Because as we already began discussing last week, whatever authority we think that poskim have, that rabbis have, there's this complexity, which is inherent in it, which is that no halachic statement or no halachic ruling can include only legal analysis. It requires application to reality, and since it requires application to reality, it requires the poseg to assess reality. And often, this is the most complicated and most controversial part of a halachic decision. Because in the end of the day, right, it's very easy to say that in theory, if X were the case, then the halacha would be Y. We could all agree on that, but trying to define whether or not we are in that situation is not so easy. So we're going to see three test cases for this. But you know, just to give the most obvious of the examples, which is the one we're going to start with after we sort of do the theory, you know, any pikuach nefesh question, right? Any question about saving a life. So I think all of us know that the basic halacha is that saving a life overrides Shabbat and saving a life overrides Yom Kippur. And therefore, in theory, we all know the halacha, which is if somebody's life is in danger, so then you can violate Shabbat and you can eat on Yom Kippur. Right? That's like, we all sort of know that. We grew up knowing that. And yet, despite that, we all know that the number of questions that people get, the number of questions that rabbis get pre-Yom Kippur is endless, right? Because everyone wants to know, well, does this fit that case? And there can be, you know, really wide divergences on this. You know, an example that I'm not going to get into too much, but I think really typifies it, is the major machloket amongst the poskim, which in my experience mostly breaks down about on geographic lines, of whether nursing is automatically a reason to not fast on Yom Kippur. And from my experience in America, most poskim that you ask will tell you no. That just because someone's nursing, that's not an automatic heter. It's not an automatic reason to eat on Yom Kippur, even in Shirim, right? Even less than the minimum amount. If a woman is particularly sick or the baby is in danger, obviously, but as a, you know, carte blanche heter, in America, almost no poseg will tell you that that's considered pikuach nefesh under normal circumstances. In Israel, the opposite is the case, where Israeli poskim across the board, and this is true in the religious Zionist community, it's true in the Haredi community, they are much more likely to give you that het there. And I know when my cousin was in the Mir, he said the standard psak in the Mir was that if a woman was nursing, a woman was pregnant, right, don't fast on Yom Kippur, have shirim, and that's it, right? Now they're arguing about the exact same halachic principle, which is pikuach nefesh overrides Yom Kippur, and yet they're assessing the reality differently. So you can see how assessment of the reality is just as important to halacha, and figuring out how you go about that, therefore, is important. So I'm going to share the screen. I want to set out the sort of the basic thesis here. And then once we do that, we'll go into, as much as we can, these three implications in order of ascending controversy, I guess. So my late teacher, Avraham Lichtenstein, in an article called Legitimization of Modernity, Classical and Contemporary, quotes the following thesis from Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik. So his father-in-law, Rabbi Joseph Dov, Halevi Soloveitchik's father, Moshe Soloveitchik, as follows. Personal judgment may be relevant, I should make that bigger, may be relevant with respect to an additional factor. The Rav once quoted his father, Rav Moshe Zal, to the effect that the nature of psak was drastically changed when formal classical smicha was terminated. Originally, a samuch, meaning someone who had smicha, who was a rabbi, at least on the Rambam's view that smicha applies to horad, yisur, v'heter, to ritual law, as well as to din, as well as to monetary law, would pronounce a decision that was binding by dint of his authoritative fiat. Now, however, the Pope's personal status has been vitiated, and with it, the standing of his decisions. Now, he essentially serves as a reference guide, providing reliable information about what the tradition and its sources properly understood and interpreted state, but it is they, rather than he, that bind authoritatively. This is a radical thesis, both conceptually and practically, with potentially momentous implications for the implementation of halakha. Legal decisions obviously entail two components: elucidation of the code or the rule, and assessment of the particular situation to which it is applied. Juridic authority is ordinarily empowered to deal with both components, and the obligation to submit to its dicta encompasses both. When violates, thou shalt not deviate, let the sermon adavershi yagidu l'chaim minusmo, the injunctions from the sentence which they shall declare unto thee to the right or to the left, by challenging the Sanhedrin's factual determination, no less than by rejecting its theoretical conclusion. Yet if one accepts Rav Moshe's contention, this ought not to be the case with respect to late periods. If a posting is only an interpretive reference guide to halakhic sources, one might accept his rendering of the contents of the halakhic corpus, but rely upon one's own judgment in evaluating the facts. So Rav Lichtenstein offers the following thesis from Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, which as in a moment he will note how radical this thesis is. But he suggests that when there was a Sanhedrin and there were people who got smicha, where they were officially initiated into the chain of tradition since Moshe, so they were granted this magical authority to both determine the theoretical law as well as to determine the reality when they were applying that law. And therefore, their halachic decision was complete, and therefore binding, not just on the theoretical level, but on the practical level as well. However, he argues, post-official smicha, post-official Sanhedrin, so that's not true. The role of the posek is to weigh in on the halachic theory, but not per se to weigh in on the facts. Now, as I already gave in the example of the nursing on Yom Kippur case, that's a big deal. Because in many ways, that's a reality dispute, right? How do you view, it's a little bit of a halachic dispute also, meaning what is the level of danger that is necessary to override the giver, but it's in many ways also a factual dispute. Like, how important do you think it is for a mother to specifically nurse rather than use formula, right? And things like that. So in that case, right, even if the posek could offer the theoretical, if he is not in charge of determining the reality, then in practice, he's not determining what the halachic answer is. And that's a very radical thesis. So before I go to Rav Aaron's critique of this thesis, why don't you tell me what you think about this thesis, right? This is a very radical thesis. What do you think about it, and what does it do, right? Can you think of circumstances in which this might create problems, not ones I've already given, right? But where does this, right? How does this complicate the way you think about halakha, how you think about halakha decision-making, particular decisions, whatever it is that this, right, makes you think about when you hear this thesis?
So, good question.
Yeah.
Because I'm not as philosophically inclined as, let's say, Rav Lichtenstein. So what he was saying is basically, up until the Sanhedrin who were, you know, actually given real smicha, after that, anyone else is there and they can really kind of give theoretical solutions, but really there's no practical solutions. All practical solutions must be from what we've read in the past. Is that what?
No, I think he's saying a little bit differently, meaning that until Sanhedrin, if the Sanhedrin said, this is a theoretical law, and this is how I read the reality in front of me, so then, from start to finish, they get to make that decision. Whereas modern poskim, their authority comes from interpreting the tradition, but, I mean, part of what you're saying is definitely true, that they are more interpreters than creators of law, that's also true, and part of that for him is that when it comes to reality, They're not like, they don't have the same authority to formulate a full halachic decision with all its factors, which includes an assessment of reality. So they are telling you what they think the tradition tells you, and that they're, you know, qualified to do, but to take it to the end, right, and say, and definitively, this is, you know, this theoretical law applies in this instance because this case looks exactly like the theoretical model, right? At some level, their authority is limited on that jump from theory to application, right? From
I mean, I think it's because based on what on that understanding, that kind of puts the entire halachic, I mean, scenario in this modern, in 21st century, even 20th century, whatever, at least my lifetime, in complete, like, I wouldn't say disarray, but it's like, the way I understood it is that there are post-game and Gedolei HaDor that we come up with new situations all the time, and they apply what they know. The way I understand it is they apply what they have learned and studied and read to the modern-day scenarios, but I would have assumed that falls into the corpus of Torah Shabbat 10.
Okay, good. So 100%, meaning I was waiting for someone to say exactly what Rosenstein said, which is, that's far too radical of a thesis to be true. Meaning, that can't be, right? Meaning, if post-Gim are just, you know, theoreticians, but then they don't, they are not qualified to read the reality, then, yeah, meaning, what do we do with all technological questions? Meaning, it doesn't help me for a post-ik to say, in theory, if something is fire, it's usher on Shabbat, if they can't tell me whether an incandescent light bulb counts or not. Or, right, it doesn't help me for a post-ik to say, you know, it doesn't help me for a post-ik to give medical stock if they can't even weigh in at all or try to figure out what the medical reality is. I mean, how are you supposed to deal with all the new shilas that come up? If they all require an assessment of reality. In fact, all of halakha requires an assessment of reality. So to say that post-Gim aren't responsible for that is, yeah, I mean, I agree with you. Right? I mean, that the first thing I would say is it's too radical to be true, right? In that form, it takes away the ability of a post-Gim to apply halakha in the real world, right? That just, it can't be true in that extreme form. It just can't be quite that true. Yeah, Matis.
It certainly is. I don't think we have that much of a problem with it. I was, before you said medical, I was going to say medical on the other side of the coin. In the medical area, I think we have no problem with the fact that the prosaic cannot assess reality himself or herself, right? That's bad for monkey. But relies on doctors, other people for the reality, and then applies the reality to that theoretical view of halacha. So I think that mitigates more towards, in that area, I think that we're okay with it somewhat, maybe less so in other areas, but to me, the medical side shows that they can't do it all, so they have to rely on others.
Perfect. So what Matis says is, well, it's radical, but maybe we're actually okay with it. Somewhat. Somewhat was a very important word there, right? Because, right, an attenuated thesis actually makes a lot of sense. Meaning, I'm totally, right, there's one thing to say, right, let's put out two theses, right? There's one thesis, which is to say, rabbis should not weigh in on medical facts at all. That's one thesis. The second thesis is, they shouldn't weigh in alone, right? Meaning they should, when they're formulating a halachic decision, they should be in consultation with experts, but they have some say in the conversation, right? Those are different claims, right? Now, I agree with Matis, right? I'm not opposed to saying they shouldn't make the decision themselves, right? Or even they shouldn't be the primary person making the decision. But that's a far cry from saying they have no say whatsoever. Because the second you say they're in conversation with doctors, right, now you got to ask, okay, but what happens in that conversation And what is the rabbi doing? Because we can imagine it in different ways, right? One way is a rabbi goes to a doctor and says, listen, if this is life-threatening, then it overrides Yom Kippur. I have now told you everything I know. I'm now out of the conversation. You talk to your patients and you figure it out yourself. I'm done, right? My part of the conversation is over, right? That's like a radical version of this, right? A less radical version is he goes to the doctor and says, listen, if the person's life is in danger, so overrides Yom Kippur, can you, can we talk about this together and figure out whether this fits the standard of pikuach nefesh, right? Based on your assessment, I'm listening to you, but I want to explain to you what these, right? Those are slightly different, right? A different one might be a person would say, listen, I'm going to ask three doctors, and I'm going to get a majority opinion. I'm not going to make my own decision, but I'm going to do the research, and I'm responsible for getting the research, right? So there, the rabbi isn't doing the figuring out the facts himself, but, or not just rabbi, right? We should be clear here, right? Posek, right? Not just rabbi, right? I don't think it's just rabbi. I mean, posek, right? Any halachic authority, but, you know, they could say, look, I'm responsible for figuring out the reality. I'm not going to do it myself, but I'm responsible for doing the research, right? Those are all different variations that all recognize that the doctor isn't the expert, or sorry, the doctor is the expert, not the rabbi, but still somehow factor in, right? Because it's very rare that you're going to find the person who themselves, right? There are very few Rabbi Dr. Aaron Gloss in the world, right, who can weigh in halachically and on the medical, right? There aren't so many of those people. I mean, there are some, but there aren't so many of those people. Yeah, Malki. You're on mute still.
Yeah. Two things. Well, maybe it's giving me more. The Gemara, the rabbis weigh in on a whole wave, a lot of subjects, certainly medical, let's say the science, that they have really, I mean, again, they might be thinking that they're experts and they might say things, but obviously when we're reading it now, 21st century, we realize that they were doing the best they possibly can with the information that they had to understand what they had. So they made those decisions. It was on them to make those decisions on science or whatever like that. So how do we, as, you know, 21st century now say, well, you know, we have other experts that we can now rely on that may not be rabbinical? That's number one. Number two is, as we're finding out now, as I'm sure we've all over COVID, you know, it's a big, big medical thing. You can ask, I mean, obviously many people look to Rabbi Glot for the solutions and for answers, but there are so many medical opinions out there, and medical and science still hasn't completely embraced and understood exactly what COVID is and what the ramifications are and how, you know, and what and things like that. You know, how do I know which posek or which doctor I should be using to get my information? Because I can't imagine that everyone was using Rabbi Glot.
Good. And so this is exactly, right? This is exactly why this is trickier than it sounds at first. Right? Because, yes, one, Malki is right, that the Gemara makes claims about reality, and you got to figure out what that tells you by the way they thought, point one, and point B, right, 1B is, and what happens when we don't understand things the way they do, because they provide medical advice, right, maybe not as rabbis, but they're definitely providing medical advice, you know, and the tradition goes back to the time of the Gaonim that we just ignore it, you know, like medical advice from the Gemara, just ignore it. You know, I remember when I was in my first year of YU, we were learning Gittin. And in the seventh paragraph of Gittin, there's like a good 2 pages of Chazal's medical advice. So someone asked for Shechter, he's like, should we learn it? He said, no. It was there. It was what was known at the time. So they were recording it, but like, we know it's wrong, so you don't have to learn it. And someone said, like, do you really mean that? Like, can we make a seum on Gittin without having ever read those pages? And he said, yeah, doesn't matter. Like, those just... This is not part of, like, that was Chazal recording their reality, you know? And we have different science, so why should you read it? It's just a waste. Like, there's no reason to do it. And then Malki's second was also right, that this, right, this doesn't in any way simplify it because, right, experts are divided. Rabbis are divided. Doctors are divided. Epidemiologists are divided, right? So, you know, no matter what you say, there's, it's not so simple what this is going to mean in practice. Yeah, I think all that's true, right? Meaning, I think this thesis is a good starting point because, you know, you think about it for a minute, like, it just forces you to think about the connection between halacha and its application. But it's very radical, and it makes you think of a lot of things that affect halacha in very significant ways. So Rav Lichtenstein pushes back on it, right? And he says, this is a radical thesis, both conceptually and practically, with potentially momentous implications for the implementation of halacha. Legal decisions obviously entail two components, elucidation of the code or the rule, and the the assessment of the particular situation to which it's applied, right? He said it's too radical. And then he jumps down and says the application of this dichotomy to the contemporary scene would neutralize much of the critique of modern orthodoxy, but it would also neutralize much else. And I think one should be reluctant to grant legitimization on so radical a thesis. On the other hand, it certainly ought not to be dismissed entirely, and it can be borne in mind as an auxiliary factor, a concept that can be appreciated by anyone familiar with the byways of Pesach, right? There's a compromise position that he suggests. So basically, the compromise position, I'll skip over here, is to say, look, it can't be true in its most extreme form, because Pesach requires assessment of reality, you can't expect Poskim to not weigh in, because then they can't do anything. But on the other hand, as Matz's notes, I'm really totally fine saying that the level of authority they exert over the assessment of the facts is very different than the authority they have over the assessment of halakha. So a more attenuated thesis, which is rabbi's primary authority is on the halakha, but in some way they are responsible for trying to figure out the reality so that they can apply the halacha, but then we got to figure out what that means, right? That, I think, is much more acceptable. And Rav Lichtenstein points, for example, to this Gemara in Sanhedrin in number 2, where the Gemara quotes Rav, who said that Shmona Atar Chadashim Gidalti Eitel Roa Behema Lida Eza Mum Kavua Veza Mum Ober. He needed to be a posek in the halacha of Mumen, of which blemishes allow Bechor, a firstborn animal, to be eaten. So he said he spent 18 months on a farm to get used to it. Now, if Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was right, that would be ridiculous at some level. Meaning, the rabbi should just know the halacha, and then he'll call in a shepherd every time he needs to know the mum. And yet I think most people read this Gemara and say, you know, that's a really responsible thing for him to do, right? If he's going to be making halachic decisions about the blemishes in animals, it's probably better for him to know what that looks like, right? That doesn't mean he has a final say. It doesn't mean that he can't consult. But, like, we think it's valuable for him to have waded in, to the reality so that he has at least a working knowledge of the facts. So this complete divorce of halakha and the reality is a bit radical, but a weaker version of it is actually very palatable. And I gave you a few Gemaras here. Like I said, I mentioned to Malki in my emails there. Sometimes, many years ago, I heard Rabbi Kenneth Brander give a shiur where he said there's two types of source sheets, right? There's source sheets that you give out, which in theory are what you want to cover in the shiur, and then there are source sheets where the purpose of the shiur is to pique people's interest. So you give a source sheet that is basically, you know, a follow-up reading for afterwards for people who were interested. So in this source sheet, I'm much more on the second one. I'm not going to read everything inside, but I want it to be here. To give an example here from Yevamot Tzadi Bet tells the following case where the Gemara says that at some point, there was a Beit Din, they were sitting around, and it was Shabbat. And they said, Shabbat is over because it was really cloudy. And then the sun came out, and they realized it had just been cloudy, Shabbat was not over. So the Gemara says, that's not considered a psak, that's considered a ta'ut, right? That's considered a mistake. It's just a mistake. Why is it just a mistake and doesn't count as a psak, and no one can hide behind it? So it seems to be, because at the end of the day, poskim can weigh in on halacha, and maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, maybe there's multiple possible answers, but there's no possible way that you can say that the sun did not, right, that the sun had set when it didn't. At the end of the day, in that case, rabbis don't have a final word on reality in a way they do on halacha. And I gave some other examples here, but I want to go to the, since I see it's already halfway through, I want to go through the three examples that I think are really important. So like I said, I want to do this in order of ascending controversy. The first one, which is, I think, maybe, as Malki has mentioned, slightly controversial as we've seen with COVID, but fundamentally less controversial, I think, than the others, is the medical case, right? So the medical case, the Gemara already recognizes that rabbis have to care about medical reality, but they're not the final say, right? So you get this in the context that I mentioned, eating on Yom Kippur, where the Mishnah says, "Ubra shehericha," if a pregnant woman smells food and develops a intense craving, "Ma'achilan atasha tashiv nasha," we can let her eat until she calms down. "Chole," a sick person, "Ma'achilan atal pikiin," so you can feed a sick person based on what the doctors say. "V'im ein sham bikiin," "Ma'achilan atal al piyatmo achiyam radai." If there aren't doctors, so then you rely on the patient. So in this case, right, what do you clearly say? Right, what's the Gemara's fundamental model that it sets up? Right, who's responsible for determining whether something is life-threatening? There's two people, the doctor or the patient, not the rabbi. Right, doctor, patient, not rabbi. Then the Gemara goes on to justify this. What happens if there's a dispute? What if the doctor says your life is not in danger and the person says, I think my life is in danger? So there we still listen to the patient because lev yodeh marat nafsho, because we assume that the patients know their own soul better. And the Gemara says, even though ma'u detem, I might have thought that rofe kim le tfei, that doctors know better, kamashmalam, that is not true. Kamash Malam, that in fact we trust patients. If patients feel like I'm dying, we trust them. So the Gemara here offers two models, a doctor and a patient. The medical side of the equation, as Matzah notes before, is definitely not the rabbi's purview. It's definitely not the rabbi's purview. It definitely, the medical assessment is made either by the patient or the doctor or both. And then the Gemara goes through all the calculations. What if the doctor says one thing, the patient says another thing, under what circumstances? Okay, fine. But fundamentally, the doctor is, and the patient make the decision. However, what does that mean? Right? So as I mentioned, the matzah is, that can mean a lot of different things. That can mean, in a radical sense, that someone comes to me in Erev Yom Kippur and says, I'm sick. It might be threatening to my life if I don't eat on Yom Kippur. Can I eat on Yom Kippur? So one model would be for me to say, look, I have no idea. If your life is in danger, you can eat on Yom Kippur. Go to the doctor you trust. Good luck. Whatever your doctor says, do. Right? I have no part to this. Right? That's one model. But again, another model is to say, you know what? You ask me the question, you know, can I have your doctor's phone number, right? Or, you know what? What are you suffering from? You have, Crohn's, right? To take a shot that I once got, right? You have Crohn's. Okay. So, I have a friend who's an expert in Crohn's. Let me call my friend who's the expert. Or I have a few friends who are experts. Let me consult, right? Those are very different models. Because in the first model, the rabbi's not involved at all. The rabbi just says, here's the halakha. Do with it what you will. Right? Ask your doctor, find your doctor, whoever you think it knows you best, go ahead. I have nothing to do with this at this point. The other is to say, I'm not the expert, but I am part of this decision, right? I just have to help you figure out, right? I have to try to do my best to cull knowledge from the experts to figure out what this looks like. So if you look, for example, in the Beit Yosef, quotes the Ramban, who says, HaRamban katav svarazo b'tchila sefer Torah Adam. The katav alev, eino nira, shelo shamanu b'sanhedrin shalchin acharov chokma. He quotes the Gaonim, who say that by medical decisions, just like rabbinic halachic decisions, you follow Rov, you follow majority. Which means the rabbi goes, he gets three doctors, and he counts. Okay, three doctors, five doctors, is it life-threatening, yes or no? Three say yes, and two say no, it's life-threatening. Vice versa, it's not life-threatening. That's it, right? That's the job of the rabbi, to collect his experts and take a vote. He doesn't make the decision, but he does his research. The Ramban agrees, sort of, but not to the number of games. And he says, Shelo shamanu b'sanhedrin shaholchin acharov chokhma, ela acharov minyan. Vadayet chanlin ashel chachamin, etc. He says, when it comes to Beit Din, we go by numbers. But when it comes to doctors, he said, we go by who's the more expert. Right? Only in halacha do we go by majority, but here we go by mechadid ekvei. Hilka choshin l'rov chachma uvikiyut l'hachmir. We follow either the expert or the numbers. So if I have five doctors, three say it's life-threatening, two say it's not, automatically it's considered safek pikuach nefesh. If four doctors say it's not life-threatening, one says it is, but he's the expert doctor, I also treat it as pikuach nefesh, right? So I go by either numbers or I go by expertise. Now again, who determines expertise? Who chooses the doctors that go into your numbers, right? Suddenly the rabbi, he's not making the decision, but he is part of the decision, right? And that's a very, again, that's a model. He's not making the decision directly, but he's also not vacating, right? He's not leaving the situation up to the patient, let's say, to figure it out for themselves. And that's very different. Now, I know Poskim would do this. I know Poskim that's their method. They ask three doctors, they get a majority opinion, and that's how they make decisions. But I remember talking once to Rabbi Dr. Judah Goldberg, who told me that he thinks it's very weird because halacha talks about rov, right? Talks about majority and talks about expertise, but modern medicine is all about statistics. And that's just not language that halacha even talks to. So trying to talk about rov and talking about getting your own experts, I mean, that's not how things work in medicine. Right, not in a globalized world where you have access to, to all the information that's constantly changing, and therefore he said, you know, it really is hard to simply apply all the models, whatever you're going to take from the poskim, and apply it to a medical decision. Therefore, I do know poskim that their opinion is not like this. Their opinion, as I have mentioned several times, is to really just tell the patient, listen, it's not my job, right? Here's the principle, and I'll talk it through. I'm happy to continue the conversation, but there's no good way of putting your finger on what the reality is. The best I can do is say, it's your life, so find the doctor you trust, right? And if they, and whatever they, right, whatever medical decision you normally make, right, whoever you trust for your medical advice, go to them. I'm happy to be part of the conversation, but fundamentally I'm giving it over to you because I don't have the tools to even figure out what the experts say in a way that's objectively better than the way you would do it, right? So again, one of those models, however you take it, whether it's majority or it's, you know, the biggest expert you can find, thinks that the rabbi's job is to be part of the equation. And one says the rabbi's job is to get out of this conversation, right, as much as possible and empower the patient with the halachic information to make their own decision in the way that they see fit, right? Those are two very very different models. Now, I will note that one of the major disputes in this context that appears in many of the posts, given I gave it to you, it's in Tiferet Yisrael, it's in the Be'er Halacha, is do you have to choose a frum doctor in order to trust them? And that's an interesting question, because at some level, if you think that the halachic question is one thing and the reality is another, so it shouldn't matter what doctor weighs in. But if you think there is an integration, then even when you ask the expert themselves should be at least in the system, right? Someone who respects the system. And that could be for one of two reasons, right? That's either because you think that halacha and reality are not completely divorced, and therefore you don't want to just sort of bifurcate completely, or it could be that you think that a certain sensitivity to halacha is required to be fair in how you read the reality, right? Because you might feel, look, if something's not really life-threatening, but you find a doctor who thinks that religion is nonsense, they'll just say it's not worth the risk. There's no real risk, but like even a one in a million, it's not worth it because this is all, you know, superstition. But if you have a doctor, either a frum doctor or maybe at least a religiously sensitive doctor, right, maybe a religious, right, Catholic or a religious Muslim who at least respects the idea of religious law, right, maybe they'll be more likely to say, you know, it's not really a risk. I mean, sure, there's a one in a million, but it's not something you wouldn't take under normal circumstances. So, like, you know, that's okay, right? I think you could take this risk and play it by ear. It's not really such a risk. And many, many postkim really do think that you have to do that. So, you know, there's a long tradition of this, but I gave you just the Be'er Halacha. I mean, I gave you a bunch, but I'm skipping down here, where the Be'er Halacha says, the Gamlin and Rofei Yisrael Sharvayim Mehem Chashudim Lavrol Divrei Torah. Even Jewish doctors, if they don't keep the Torah, Chalal Shabbat Gamlin Mitanim Mitarach Karuta, and they don't fast on Yom Kippur, so Tzarach Iyun Rav in Yesh L'Smoch Aleihem. You really have to wonder whether you can trust them, right? And in the end of the day, what he says, V'Emena Davar Talul Lefi Ra'odei Ne'amoreh. It's left up to the posek to figure out what doctors are sensitive enough to even weigh in on the question. And again, you see that that line between halacha and reality gets blurred in important ways, because what this recognizes is that at some level, all assessments of reality require a certain value judgment, right? Because you need to be able to say, is it worth it? And in order to say it's worth it, there's value implied there. And therefore, this clean split is a little bit complicated, and that's why, right, people go to someone like Rabbi Glot, because he's both an expert in infectious disease, but he's also, you know, a knowledgeable postdoc, and therefore, you know, even if he's not, you know, going to poskin purely by himself, he's sensitive to the needs of the community and the things that you balance with health enough to weigh in a balanced way that respects both the halacha and the reality. Okay, so that's example one, which, as I said, has a bit of controversy in it, but fundamentally, I think, are all within the realm of, you know, I think none of this is, like, shocking. I know in practice sometimes people get really heated about it, but I don't think any of these views are shocking. But let me throw out an example, a second example, which is, I think, much more charged. And this is an example not from medical, but from politics. Okay? So this is the case of land for peace. So I'm going to give you quickly the halachic background. Okay? I'm not going to read it inside, but I gave it to you if you're interested in the main sources. The question of whether you can trade land for peace is a halachic and a reality machloket. The first question is giving up land in Eretz Yisrael actually stronger than regular mitzvot and actually unwittingly a one that overrides pikuach nefesh, that overrides the saving of life. That position is taken by the Minchat Chinuch, because the Minchat Chinuch says as follows. The Ramban writes that fighting for Israel and waging war to conquer Israel is part of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, living in Israel. And the Minchat Chinuch says, well, war always includes death. And therefore, you learn that by definition, war and the things that you're obligated to fight for are actually, even though they're not technically the big three, they do require risking your life. So the Minchat Chinuch puts out a halachic argument that even if your life was in danger, you wouldn't necessarily be allowed to, the Minchat Chinuch sets the groundwork, rather, for a position that even if people's lives were in danger, it's not necessarily true that would be enough to trade land in Israel. Step one. Step two, even if you don't agree with the Minchat Chinuch, and you think, no, if people's lives were in danger, you would be allowed to trade land for Israel, even if that's forbidden, which it arguably is based on the Gemara in Avodah Zarah Daf Chaf, that says that you can't give up land to non-Jews, idolaters. Can't get into that now, but that's obviously part of the halachic question. You can give it up in order to save lives if you agree with point two. So then the next situation is, great, now what? Who gets to decide that giving up land in Israel will save lives rather than endanger them more or leave the situation as it is? Right? And as we know, if you remember when this was, you know, before disengagement, this was a very heated dispute amongst politicians, amongst rabbis, amongst pretty much everyone in Israel. So Rav Schechter wrote an article as follows, right? He ruled halachically that you are allowed to trade land to save lives. But then here he says, but who is authorized to make this crucial decision? To shed light on this question, let us return to the point that sakanat nefashot must be disregarded when waging war. Right, so he gets to the whole halachic question, and then he says, look, in answer to this, it would appear that at the heart of our preparedness to fight for Eretz Israel is the fact that Israel's role today is as the national home of the Jewish and of the Jewish people. Since a nation's land is vital to its existence as a nation state, to the point that in various limited contexts, only those Jews residing in Israel are considered full members of Klal Yisrael, conquest by a foreign power is considered a lethal blow to the essence of the conquered nation. Therefore, just as a doctor would amputate a patient's limb in order to save a life, when the life of an entire nation is endangered, it's permitted to sacrifice the lives of the few for the purpose of sparing the nation at large. Thus, the question at hand seems comparable to that of a sick individual who must decide the course of action his doctor should undertake. Right? So Rav Schechter says, well, conceptually, this is actually the same question as a patient who has to figure out how they're going to save their life and what that means halachically. Okay, so what does that mean on a national scale? So here he throws out a bunch of possibilities. He said at some point in time that might have been the Sanhedrin, but nowadays it's not. So therefore he says, just as only the individual patient and not his rabbis may decide which form of treatment to undergo, in this case too, the opinion of rabbinic leaders should carry no more weight than that of anyone else. Yet, if military experts insist that it's impossible for Israel to maintain permanent control over Judea and Samaria, then even if the opinion of the entire Israeli population were unanimously otherwise, their demand would not be heeded. Again, we draw on the medical analogy. If all medical experts agree that they are unable to prolong the life of a particular patient, even if the patient insists that he receive a specific form of treatment, his request would be ignored. Only in a situation in which the doctors themselves admit that there are valid considerations favoring either possibility is the decision left to the patient. Therefore, in this case, in which military experts claim that it is possible to maintain control of Judea and Samaria, but at the cost of regular losses in lives, it is for the public to decide whether the war is worth fighting. in challenging the majority of Klal Yisrael, and this also be stipulated, not everyone who is Jewish is considered a member of Klal Yisrael for this purpose. Among the criteria for qualified membership is that the individual be a mamin, it goes on, right, and that he lives there, right? And he goes on. So Schefter does this very fascinating conceptual move. He says, look, politics are parallel to the medical question. And therefore he says, look, if there was only one medical procedure to save someone's life, you would listen to the doctor and no one else. Equivalent in politics, if every general said the only way to save lives is to give away land, we would do it. If there's a machloket amongst experts, so we would ask a patient, which danger do you want to take? Not having surgery, having surgery, etc. And here too we ask the patient. And those are basically the Jews living in Israel who get to vote through the democratic process, and they figure out what it is that they're willing to risk because they are the quote-unquote patient, right? So this is Rav Schechter's attempt at basically applying this insight that rabbis' jobs are provide the halacha but not the reality into a political situation. However, there were many who disagreed. So, for example, I didn't give this to you inside, but Rav Malamud, in a debate he had at Yeshivat Har Tzion, at my alma mater, and they published this in a book which just records all the shiurim that were given in advance of this engagement, actually argued the opposite. He said, no, this is like what the Mishnah Berurah said about from doctors, right? Just like we see the poskim say that you can't trust people, you can't trust doctors who don't value Yom Kippur to really make a decision. He said the same thing is true here. And he says, and this is really a radical thesis, but he says, no, the only people in the world who can make the reality decision are the rabbis. Because the only people who will read the reality with the proper bias, meaning with the lenses of the importance of Eretz Yisrael, only they will read the reality in the proper ideological light. right, which is literally the opposite extreme of what Rav Schechter argues, and this really became one of the major points of dispute between Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Avram Shapira, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Merkaz HaRav at the time. And I gave you here, you can read it in English, they're back and forth, I gave you only a percentage of it, all of it's online. And this is really what Rav Lichtenstein pushed back on. Right, Rav Lichtenstein turned to Rav Shapira, who forbade it, and said, do you simply deny absolutely that these scenarios are possible, being convinced beyond any shadow of a doubt that rightness and logic are to be found exclusively on the among the professionals who advised it? And if so, one asks respectfully, what is the basis of this absolute certainty? Is it assessment of the situation, faith and trust, or God's secret revealed to those who fear him? Meaning, you seem to think that you know that this is dangerous and the alternative is definitely better. How do you know? Did God tell you that? Meaning, do you think God told you the reality? Right, and he goes on to quote Rabbi Soloveitchik, who says that rabbis can weigh in on halacha, but not necessarily on reality. And Rav Shapira pushes back on him, and he says, no, the politicians are biased too, and therefore, and they argue, and therefore, yeah, I get to make the decision, not them, right? And you see, and again, you can look at the nuances, but you see how this same dispute plays out in a much, much more extreme level in the political arena. Okay, I see I have 7 minutes left, so let me throw this out in 2 minutes. And then we'll talk about it. The third one, which is something I've mentioned several times, is psychological reality. And this, I'll mention two very controversial cases. Now, unfortunately, we don't have time to talk about it, but like I said, the point was to whet your appetite. Chazal make a lot of psychological assumptions. And they base halacha on it. Rav Chanan Wasserman claims that every time Chazal make a psychological assumption, it's metaphysically true forever. Therefore, based on an idea like that, and they're not quoting Rav Chanan, Rabbi Soloveitchik had famously pushed back on a proposal by Rabbi Rachman, which went as follows. The Gemara says, and I'm gonna unshare the screen for a second so I can see everybody. But why can't I do this? Here we go. Rabbi Rachman had suggested as follows. The Gemara says that any woman would rather to be married even to a bum than to not be married. Therefore, the standards to define something as a kiddushei ta'ut, right, as a mistaken marriage, to get a woman out of a dead marriage, are very, very high and can't always be met. Based on this, Rabbi Rachman has said, that might have been true in the time of the Gemara, but it's not true now. Now, if a woman finds out her husband is abusive or would withhold a get or whatever the case may be, she would never have wanted to get married, and therefore we can deem her kiddushin to be a mekach ta'ut, and we can undo her marriage. Rabbi Soloveitchik pushed back and said, that can't be. Because when halacha says that women would rather be married, that's a metaphysical statement about reality. And therefore, you can't say that. Right? You're just wrong. And therefore, that's not a way out of marriage. And as you see, at some level, this is a... Now, this is a little bit different because it's a question about what were Chazal doing when they made assessments of reality. But it's a related question, which, as we know, the Aguna question, how to resolve it, is a very, very major and controversial question. Second question that I'll throw out that we already mentioned last week is, as I mentioned before, many rabbis say something along the following when it comes to women's issues. If I believe that women were doing it for the right reasons and that it wouldn't lead to more radical anti-halachic things, I'd be okay with them learning. But they're all doing it because they have a radical feminist agenda, right? And then many people respond and say, who are you to tell me what's going on in my head? Meaning, you may be a great posek, and you may be able to say the halacha, which is, if someone's doing it for the wrong reason, then it's not a good idea. Maybe you can say that. But you're not making a halachic statement. You're making a reality statement, which is, this is what I mean in my head. When I say I care about Torah, and I'm learning it because I care about Torah, you hear me say, I'm a radical feminist who doesn't care about Torah values. That's not what I'm thinking. You might, right? Who are you to define the reality in my head, right? So as I said, I just wanted to give you three examples and to show you how, I don't know if this is, I think it's probably order of ascending controversy, but only because the Land for Peace hasn't been on the table for a few years. Otherwise, I don't know which one's more controversial. But the point of this is to point out that when we say that poskim might not have the same authority over reality than they do over halacha, so that complicates things in medical decisions, sure. But when it comes to politics or Jewish politics, right, suddenly, if you really believe that, this is very radical, right? Because that means, right, if you believe that poskim do weigh in on reality, then they might get to weigh in on whether something's a danger to Israel or not. Where if you say they don't have that right, then they can provide the halacha, but the democratic system or the military experts have to decide it. If you really believe that poskim can't determine reality, then any decision, even like the relatively mild one that we saw from Rav Henkin last week, which was, I think that partnership and yanim are technically mutter, but I think that these people are outside of the Orthodox mainstream. In the end of the day, that's a sociological statement, right? Does that mean that that statement means nothing halachically, right? Because it's a reality statement, or it means something less than his sock, right? Maybe, right? And therefore, the implications of recognizing even the more tame version that Mata suggested before, right? Which is not that rabbis have nothing to do with reality, but they have a much weaker claim over it. So by medical cases, like I said, I think most poskim are pretty comfortable saying that. But those same people, if you turned around to say to them and said, listen, you think that, you know, this women's issue is a bad idea because you think I'm doing it for the wrong reasons, but you're not in my head, so I really don't care, right? What you say really just doesn't matter because, right, suddenly we understand that's a really It's a really controversial thing to say. It might still be right, right? But it's a very potentially potent weapon, right? In the hands of people who want to neutralize critique, right? So what sounds like a relatively benign claim in the medical context, maybe it's a little bit complicated in practice, but it's mostly benign. Suddenly in politics and Jewish politics, it's not a benign claim at all, right? It's a very powerful weapon. So I wanted to throw that out there, right? Because, so much of this, and again, we haven't even gotten into Das Torah, right? But before we even get into Das Torah, whether Poskin can decide on meta-halachic things and things like that, even if we just decided that they can't determine reality, right, that neutralizes a lot of claims that are often made in the halachic world. And therefore, it's really important to figure out whether we really believe that this distinction exists. And if so, just how sharp of a distinction is it? And what are the limits? And are there differences between medical reality and political reality and psychological and social realities, right? Those questions are really, really important to answer. But like I said, the reading, the Makarot for this week was more of a, I hope I piqued your interest, and now I've given you 9 pages if you want to see how this plays out more in depth. So I'm going to say it's there for you, and you can read it. Obviously, you can follow up with me afterwards on it. But we'll take questions, but for anyone who has to leave, thank you for learning with me. It's been a lot of fun, and I hope that I've opened more questions than I've answered so that you're committed to exploring the halakhic process more, because, as I've mentioned a few times throughout the series, I really do believe in a vision where members of the halakhic community are really engaged in it and really challenge it and understand what's going on behind the scenes to really value what it is they're doing. When they ask a question, what is under the rubric of asking a question? Again, we haven't covered everything, but I hope I at least piqued your interest to the complexities that are here and why it is so important to really engage in the process, to be a producer, right? Or at least be a educated consumer of halakha, because I really do think it creates a deeper connection to halakha and better halakha when the people who are asking questions, even if they never decide they want to be posting themselves, know enough and understand enough and are engaged enough to push back. Because at the very least, conversation between post-gym and an educated non-post-gym creates a much healthier and much stronger dialogue around halakha and much deeper commitment. So thank you for coming and learning with me, and we'll throw it out for whatever questions people have now. When I was talking about land in Israel, yeah, I meant halakhic Israel. But that's part of that conversation there where, meaning in the land for Israel dispute, there were some poskim who were a little bit more amenable to giving away places which are not historically halakhically Israel, which was part of like the discussion with some of the stuff in the Negev, with the deal with Egypt, which was a little bit, yes. And Gush Katif was also part of that in a certain way. So yes, that is part of the decision. But like I said, this is just a, to pique interest. So that is part of the question, but it complicates it. And yes, obviously the marriage questions raise a host of issues because there's a whole number of reasons why we might think that marriage then was different than now. And like I said, I only touched on it to highlight why these questions are important. Okay, so I throw it out to you to finish off the series, at least for now, and I hope we learn together again.
Questions. And of course, as usual, what they're doing is always open to follow-up emails or questions.